Hello, and welcome to the M4 Death Trip. I'm Howard Ingham. Although we're mainly talking this time about the cars that ate Paris, it's been a while since John and I last did a podcast, so we had some catching up to do, and it gave us a chance to talk about John's impressions of the 2017 London Film Festival, which is where we come in.
Overall, I didn't think the London Film Festival was quite as good this year as it was last year. But I tend to avoid the galas because those are the films that will get a major cinematic release in the UK anyway. So I try and look for films that either won't get a release or you don't know if they'll get a release. Nevertheless, the standout films for me were Hagazusa, which was it's German made but set in Austria. I suppose folk horror is the convenient label you would give it by a director called Lukas Fagerfield. And it starred no one I knew, but was it described itself as like a dark legend of the Austrian Alps, but in reality was a story about an isolated girl shunned by even the meagre local society which she lives by, because they think she's a witch, and people grow up to fear her, and it's about her isolation and the effects of that, and that was very powerful and very moving, and very, very sad. You have a feminist folk horror film. There you go. That's what that was. What else was good? Life Guidance. I enjoyed very much. Again, another Austrian film from Ruth Mader, which is set in a slightly dystopian future where. It's the model of perfect capitalism, and our hero is getting rather bored and jaded with his life when life guidance come in and tell him what he should be doing. But it's sort of a fun, delightfully subversive film. Particular favourite of mine is when the sat nav recommends he doesn't take that road because that's going to go down to an area of town he really doesn't want to go down, and then starts to persuade him, trying to more and more hysterically as he deliberately goes down the road to annoy the sat nav. That was nice. Memoir of a Murderer, I recommend, which Wan Xinyan's interesting take on a serial killer film, which has an ex-serial killer who's starting to suffer from Alzheimer's, thinks his daughter's dating a serial killer because he recognises the symptoms, as it were.
that's the darkest comedy idea ever.
Yeah, but he's suffering from Alzheimer's. He's starting to he's doubting whether or not you're actually whether he can piece it together in time, save the daughter, or indeed whether it's the boyfriend really is a serial killer or just using him. But yeah, Sol Kyung-gu is it, and he gives an absolutely superb performance as the main guy. And probably the last film I'd recommend, particularly there was plenty of others I saw that were quite good, was an Icelandic film called we have to excuse my Icelandic pronunciation. It's called Rocken, how do you pronounce that in Icelandic? It translated into English. It's Twilight, For obvious reasons, the English language distributors did not want that marketed in the UK as Twilight.
No, I can see that.
And that's a very haunting film about It's called Rift, by the way. That's the title they gave it, in the, which doesn't really is nowhere near as good a title as Twilight. So I try to keep it as rock and roll. Anyway, the film's about a man gets a phone call from his ex lover, who's up at one of their parents' summer houses in the north of Iceland, but in the middle of winter, and he goes about it. He's being a bit weird, and then someone may be stalking them, or he may not. The boyfriend may not really be there. But that's lovely. It was who was the director? Erlinger Fraudson, I think, something like Fraudson.
Okay.
He was unknown to me. I think he's from looking him up. I think at the time he had some history in horror, but this was sort of intelligent. It used the landscape well. It engaged the audience well. It had that sort of sense of unease and discombobulation about it, rather than horror, which I'm a big fan of. So they were my particular highlights from the London Film Festival. Other things that I saw, like Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson's Ghost Stories, which was interesting and fairly enjoyable, but doesn't quite work on its own terms as a film. It's adapted from their stage play, which I enjoyed very much. But yeah, there's a thing. And what's the worst film I saw? I was going to say Downsizing, which is the Alexander Payne film, the guy who did Nebraska, about people getting shrunk and creating communities that they can live like kings because their money goes further and they're not consuming anywhere near the resources. But it doesn't deal with the ills. I mean, you find quickly on when he's when Matt Damon has become shrunk and lives in this community, his life falls apart really quickly. But then he gets involved with people who live like in the underworld, the dispossessed, the urban poor, basically, as we recognise them in society. But there's no explanation for why this utopia suddenly has a large dispossessed population, as I said, an immigrant and ostracised population. It doesn't explore that, and it should do.
Doesn't really take it anywhere.
No, it doesn't. It's just there, and there's poor people, help them, but they're good people, really. They're good people. Why did they get shrunk if they were going to live in this zone? Why did that happen? I thought they were going to explore that, and they didn't, and it was overlong and indulgent. But I think the worst film I did see was an Irish film called David Frayn's The Cured, which I was really looking forward to because it was a post-zombie film.
Oh, right. People have been zombies and get better.
Yeah, they've been cured. But they remember what they did. And, of course, if your loved ones have been torn apart by a man that was a zombie and he's now fine, you're probably not going to be overly well disposed towards him, even though rationally it wasn't his fault. And I thought, oh God, I hope this isn't going to be a sort of heavy allegory on Muslims and immigration. And it wasn't. It was Irish republicanism as plague. And I thought it was quite. It started to say that when they said the disease was called maize, I seemed like. And in Ireland, maize prison, And then by the end, when you've got lots of these mindless zombies, when the infection gets out again, you've got lots of these mindless zombies attacking army checkpoints. And okay, well, we're just the IRA of zombies is what I took away from that, and I found that a bit. I mean, it's made by Irish people. I don't want to come in and say that's offensive. I'm telling you, as an Englishman.
Yeah, Irish splaining. Yeah. No, don't do that.
But yeah, I was uncomfortable with that. That's the central message I took from it. But perhaps I'm completely wrong. But yeah, I really didn't like that. But so they were the other for the first four were my particular choices from the London Film Festival.
Amazing, right? So we decided this time to watch The Cars That Ate Paris.
It's a win. first film, isn't it?
Peter Weir's first film, yes. And it's generally regarded as a classic of Australian cinema, and also kind of the root of a lot of great themes that Australian cinema picks up and runs with through the 70s, the 80s, and after.
Mad Max the Pilot.
There's a bit of Mad Max there. There are other themes as well, but it's not like Peter Weir's other films in a lot of ways. It's
in a huge amount of ways. It's like, if you're didn't you say that your what did you say the DVD box?
Oh, the DVD has on the front, it's like from the maker of Good Will Hunting and Dead Poets Society. Which,
that's for Love the Truman Show. Watch this.
It's like a copy of Brain Dead with from the maker of Heavenly Creatures and the Lord of the Rings on the front.
I think we said while watching it that there was a similar trajectory to early Peter Jackson and early Peter films. Yes, and suitably, it doesn't take long to build up. He may have learned something about pacing after making this when he made Picnic at Hanging Rock, but I'm not sure those lessons were particularly positive ones. Anyway, I'm not going to rant about how indescribably boring Picnic at Hanging Rock is. You've heard that.
We've had that discussion.
So we start off with it's a couple in a car, don't we?
Yeah, we start with a couple in a car, and they're a middle-class couple, and it plays like something aspirational, doesn't it? Right to the...
Road movie, getting away, it's a bit...
Yeah, but like an advert, too. At one point, you know, he gives her a cigarette, and he does a close-up on the packet of cigarettes, almost as if...
It's a couple of cuts of luck. I couldn't work out whether actually they really did give them some money for it, or whether it was a subversive pastiche on product placement.
I thought it was a pastiche on adverts. I thought it was a pastiche on, you know, it's like this, they live an advertisement lifestyle and they go, you know, on a road trip, this beautiful aspirational couple straight out of an advert. And then they're driving in the dark and the light shine in their faces and they crash and they both die.
And it was a strong opening. I mean, it wasn't a pre-title sequence or anything. Was it a pre-title sequence?
I think it was a pre-title sequence, yeah.
It was a pre-title sequence, yeah. It has that sort of cliffhanger view. Now we're going into it, which then I was initially nonplussed by, because what we cut to is something exactly the same.
Except it's not, because it's two guys who are looking for work, one of whom is much better known in cinema for playing Napoleon in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
You know, I've never seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
I know. You've got no intention of doing so. And to be honest, it's a film that you only want to see when you're 17.
Yeah, indeed.
And it's not too late. After.
It's like trying to show Star Wars. It's trying to show Star Wars to an adult that has never seen it. It's too late. It's too late now. Having said that, I did watch E.T. for the first time only about three or four years ago. And very much enjoyed it.
I still haven't managed to see that movie.
Oh, really? No, that's lovely and genuinely funny, heartwarming, but not schmaltzy. Anyway, that's right here. See, no, I didn't think it juxtaposed enough. When you have a pre-title sequence, oh my God, what's this? Then you cut to something else. And then I like the intrigue of how that will join up. Here I saw a couple crash in a car, and then I see two people in a car with a caravan on the back driving along in the same environment.
Except everything that they're signified as is poor.
Yes.
The indeed. Other couple are signified as wealthy and aspirational, and these guys are a bit seedy. They're not good looking. They're kind of, you know, everything's rickety and poor for them. Their car is a bit of a mess.
Yeah, I get it. It doesn't matter where you're from. People of this town will kill you and steal your car parts. No matter, it's a great leveller.
Because that's what's happening.
Yeah.
They're laying a booby trap on a particularly dangerous stretch of road and stealing the bits of the car and making a trade from them.
Is they're lobotomizing the survivors.
Yeah, with Chekhov's medical Black and Decker.
Yeah, that wasn't so. I think we both noticed at the end. Why is there a big drill with a medical cross on the back?
Yeah, like a full-on Black and Decker kind of electric drill, and it's got like a white stripe on it with a red cross. And it's like we're both sitting there, and we're both like, "That's going to see use in 10 minutes' time."
Indeed.
And it did.
It did. Yes, yes. Similarly to the revelation that the surviving brother of the car that crashes, and he comes out physically relatively unscathed, although they're mentally damaged, can't drive. And that's this is a film all about cars. He is the other. He is that exposes him not only as an outsider, but as a person who's permanently disadvantaged within the framework of the community now.
Who are obsessed with driving, and it's all about driving, the roads. And I think Australia, you get the idea that Australia has a road culture in a way that obviously in the UK we don't, because like the US in that respect, it's got big wide open spaces and driving is the only way to get across them.
Oh yeah, I mean, Australia has a long history of car films. Not, I mean, Mad Max would be the obvious, the obvious one. But you've got what's the one that where the car splits in? Malcolm. Have you seen Malcolm?
I have not. No.
But you know of it, yeah.
No, I don't.
Oh no, sorry, I wasn't setting you up for going looking at that. That's like a crime escape film, and the car, there's a car that's manufactured to split in half.
Oh, right.
Anyway, no, what it was making is that there's the landscape and setup of Australia makes it conducive to films centered around cars. That's
yes, indeed. And actors in the film who are in movies where cars play a vital role abound. So you have David Melian, plays
Mad Max 2 and 3.
Walkabout.
Walkabout, yes. The other guy that's, sorry.
Yeah, Bruce Spence.
Bruce Spence.
From Mad Max 2 and Mad Max 3.
The gyrocopter guy, isn't he?
Yeah, the gyro guy in those films. And he plays, he's evidently a brain damaged survivor of a previous crash.
Not dissimilar to his character in Mad Max.
Yes, pretty much. And Melissa Jaffa, who is, I think she plays the mayor's wife in the Cars Out of Paris. And of course, she's long-standing Australian character actress, Jim Henson puppeteer.
And, is she? That's...
Yeah, she did the puppets and also a front of camera role in Farscape, the Muppets in Space show that was around some years ago. And
by the way, sorry, apropos of nothing, just for a random not affair, the lead Scacy in Dark Crystal, the guy doing the voice, that's Michael Kilgareth, who's the cyber controller from Doctor Who. And the robot, yes, yeah. Anyway, that was a fact I learned relatively recently, and the Jim Henson thing made me.
Yes, yeah, oh yeah, okay. But yeah, mainly Melissa Jaffa would be known to a lot of cinema audiences now as one of the badass grannies in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes, she is.
She plays
with the window onto the soul of the community, because she befriends the our hero, doesn't she?
And she's also adopted two little girls, and that's another uniquely horrible bit thing. You know, whose family died in an accident.
They have children, but not, yeah, they selectively keep surviving people from the car crash, but
they can never leave. So Arthur is one of a series of people, and he's not really much of a protagonist, is he? Stuff happens to him.
He doesn't. I mean, he's not particularly bad, but you see everything from his perspective.
Yes, he's a point of view character rather than...
He is, but then if you want to look at... I mean, we know he can't drive. Is that the same as Sergeant Howie's virginity?
And it goes in the opposite direction with Arthur.
Yeah, but is there much more character than this? This is our window onto this world. He tries to, you know, he tries to make sense. He realizes something's wrong. But you go with him because he's your only perspective. He's the only perspective you're really given. You see flashes of the town council meetings, but they're superfluous. You never really understand any sort of internal conflict or relationship beyond the setup of the community. That's why made me think of Howie. He's you don't know a huge amount about him beyond what's necessary for him to be relevant to the story. But
yes,
he is the one perspective you really get.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Arthur's basic trajectory is that the town keep looking for ways to keep him. They keep finding ways to fix things for him to stay by finding him more than one job. So one of his jobs is in the hospital, which houses the lobotomized survivors of car crashes that the town has engineered. It was interesting that, like, pretty much all, like, the real crazy motorist violence that the film's reputation rests on all happens in the last 12 minutes.
And it's a bit of a steep curve up to there, isn't it? You know at the beginning that people are engineering car accidents, but that's not the same as terrorizing people with outlandishly customized vehicles.
And vehicles that are so iconic that they'll be reused in other Australian post-apocalyptic movies.
Indeed. But it's only for the last 10 minutes where the people turn up and destroy the town. You don't get that sense of a permanent danger beyond that.
Yeah, but you just see the young people getting a little bit more antsy as time goes on.
It goes from the sort of folk horror, I won't go into say the Wicker Man, but it goes from a folk horror vibe of an outsider, isolated community. They've got some sort of weird secret that they don't want to talk about, and our guy can't really leave. But it goes from that, and to the end, it goes to, you know, psychomania or something like that as well. And becomes intergenerational. It's the young people drive around and destroy the guard, and the old guard want to keep the town the way it is for their own ends.
And they want to, and the town destroys itself, basically. The town essentially implodes. And Arthur, who's not part of it, realizes that actually the trauma that prevents him from driving is no longer the worst trauma in his life. He's like, right, I can drive. And
by the end of the film, he's the only person driving as everyone walks out of the town.
Well, yeah, actually, you're right. I'd not picked up on that particularly interesting piece of subtext, but you're right. That's he drives.
And he doesn't offer anyone else a lift.
Would you?
What a shit. Yeah, but it's not like all the town's bad. I mean, you know, the mayor's wife, she was nice. Could give her a lift.
The kids.
The kids, yeah, the young kids. Not only presuming they're not dead. We don't even see if he's got any petrol though. To be honest, I mean, he could run out 100 yards down the road, and it was like, oh, that's the cars that ate Paris too. The sequel we need to make. Ultimately, what did you think of it? I mean, my overriding feeling when I saw it was, it really zips along for the first third, but then the pacing drops off hugely once Arthur's established in Paris. Then it's iceberg slow until the last 10 minutes when the town gets destroyed by the cars. And I found that.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, lovely half hour at the start. Big longer in the middle. Big thrust of really fast post-apocalyptic violence. Everything goes boom at the end. Just to finish it off. And there's no slow build. There is a build-up, but it's not a particularly sort of steady build-up. There's just a couple of isolated events. Part of it is that the mayor decides to make Arthur the parking attendant, make him the traffic warden, except he wears an outfit that looks like he's in the Wehrmacht.
I thought he was seen as the least effective, most disposable bit of the Third Reich. But I suspect I'm reading too much into that.
Yeah, it was a faintly Nazi-inflected uniform, I think.
I was thinking of Simon Pegg's character in the Hitler sketch, in Big Train.
Right.
When they're at the party and it's like Hitler and Himmler like, with all the girls. And with varying degrees of uniforms, people are more in and out of the action. But Simon Pegg's like in an SA uniform, and he's like he's seen as a bit of a spare wheel. But I'm probably reading too much into that. It's clear that they set Arthur up as the fall guy. Here's an impossible situation to deal with. We can't or won't deal with it. Let's make this guy the solely responsible for it, and watch him fail, watch him be the fall guy, and then we've got an out.
Yeah, yeah, and I think mainly, I was disappointed. I think that the reputation of the film worked against it. I think if I hadn't had generally the sort of cultural sort of feed into me that this is one of the greatest movies ever made, great Australian movie, at the heart of Australian cinema, fantastic, mad, crazy, and all those things, and just a truly great movie, and I sort of came and it was like, nah, it was all right.
That's how Walkabout, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and Waking Fright were marketed to me. I'm not sure that that's how The Cars That Ate Paris were. This was marketed to you as
yeah, a great Australian movie.
Film canon.
Yeah.
Wow. I know. I may have preferred it to you simply for the reason that I didn't come with that level of expectation.
Yeah.
I heard it was a bit batshit when I found out that my boss's husband took her to see it on honeymoon.
Oh, date movies.
Yeah, that is a good date movie. That is, and even if I was wavering whether I liked Because They're Paris, and ultimately I did. Ever seen a bloke with a foot up his nose is a quote I'm not going to forget for a long while.
Indeed. So yeah, the Cars That Ate Paris is an interesting film, and you can see, as we've mentioned a few times now, but you can see how other Australian movies that people generally sort of rate draw from it. So Mad Max, the first Mad Max, is essentially that same setting more or less, but with a policeman, and also not played for laughs in the way.
No, there's one obvious difference with it. There's no humour. It's taken that. I said when watching, I'm not sure if the humour's if I really, really want the humour in this, but then that probably doesn't help that I've seen Mad Max first and liked that. So if I'd have seen this first and think, oh, that's nice, it's subversive. This is also quite unsubtly edited. There's quite a lot of slashing cuts in this that are very obviously that are not the best timed cuts.
Yeah, yeah. You. I seem to remember at the time you were saying that's a bad cut.
Yeah,
and things. It's clearly someone learning the ropes.
Oh, indeed, yeah, indeed. But it's. I wonder if you thought to go back and make a new edit of it, or if thought, oh, sod it, you know.
I think he's probably moved on. I mean, Peter.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
I mean, what else did he make? He made Gallipoli. He made Goodwill. No, not Goodwill Hunting. That's Damon and Affleck, isn't it? He made The Truman Show.
Yeah, did the Truman Show.
We did the Last Wave. Society.
The Last Wave, which you're a big fan of, aren't you?
No.
Oh, he did Green Card, didn't he? Do Green Card.
Oh, Green Card, yeah. Romantic comedy with Gerard Depardieu.
Yeah, which is now the most terrifying thing to think of.
Comedy with Gerard Depardieu. Yeah, wow. Yeah, no, Dead Poets Society is a film that I've I've loathed for many years, absolutely despised. The Truman Show, I liked it when I saw it in the cinema, but I was 21, so I've no idea if it holds up. But a lot of these films are big prestige movies. He makes prestige movies now.
He did. A big budget one of his. I enjoyed Master and Commander. I enjoyed Master and Commander.
Okay, cool. But no, The Last Wave, which is obviously his third film, his like third serious film, has a lot of good things to say, and it's got a lot. His heart is completely in the right place, and its subtext is fantastic, and it's dense and it's multi-layered, and oh, it's glacial. You know, it feels.
If only he had four on making really, really, really glacial films.
Which brings us to Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Hanging Rock. It's beautiful. It's gorgeously shot. And if I wanted to watch 3-minute footage of some ants running around, then I'd go and watch David Attenborough.
I think that's ultimately like the sticking point with Picnic at Hanging Rock, isn't it? It's like, if you're prepared to just sit there and soak in the visuals and relax for a bit and not worry, you're probably okay. If you're actually looking for an engaging and complex plot, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's not a lot to be complex about the plot. The schoolgirls go missing and there's no explanation, and no one ever came up with one. And we don't really get a chance to try and to explore that. And I'm not sure if we tried to, and whatever we wanted to put on it would have been would have been any better. I just thought it was lovely. It was beautifully, beautifully shot, and with a gorgeously ethereal, eerie soundtrack. It could just have been tightened up to have been a bit more scary and eerie. And the long sweeping shots took me out of the drama a bit. But hey, maybe I'm a Philistine. It is.
Picnic at Hanging Rock, though. I think mainly it reminded me of a film I really liked as well, which is. A film called Helen. I don't know if you've seen that. It's from about. It's a British film from about 8 years ago. It's about a girl goes missing, and there's a girl who is just leaving care, who is recruited to be her stand-in in the police reconstruction of the girl's last known whereabouts, and the homeless girl. Begins to get some sort of insight as to this other girl's life and begins to, in many ways, take her place by getting to know her family and stuff. And what's interesting about the film is that it could go in a number of bad directions, but doesn't. It is glacially slow, and it's very considered and gentle and everything. And there's no explanation for the disappearance of the missing girl or anything like that. That's never resolved. But then that's not what the film's about. And I think Picnic at Hanging Rock, there's no resolution. Apart from, you know, one of the girls is found, but she can't say anything. And she's treated as a pariah by her classmates. One girl who gets left behind, like the kid who gets left behind in the Pied Piper story, ends up committing suicide. And there's these two boys who, you know, in another movie might have been accused of raping and murdering the missing girls, but aren't, and, you know, find one of the girls and end up being haunted by it. And it's essentially, the film's not about the disappearance, it's about the haunting.
Yeah, but I didn't really get that it was about, it spent too long on the setup for me to it to be about that. Anyway, we're not talking about
We are kind of talking about Peter Weir now, which
We're talking about Peter Weir's odd attitude to pacing, which I think, I mean, at least in Picnic at Hanging Rock, the pacing isn't uneven. It's glacial all the way through. And I was pleasantly surprised with the Cars That Ate Paris. This is zipping along quite nicely.
And then but it wasn't.
Where's that middle bit where he's? It starts with a fairly efficient sort of montage of the town going about its day, which making it seem all the weirder and more unwelcoming, which I thought was really good. But around the time that I think they go to church and you have that the cynical vicar, and he wants to talk to the cynical vicar because the cynical vicar doesn't seem to be quite as on board with the machinations of the town as everybody else. But he's waylaid by the mayor as the mayor becomes aware of Arthur's suspicions. And about that time, I'm thinking this is taking far too long. Actually, even in the in the climax, where there's a bit where there's a car stuck inside
yeah,
and it's banging back and forward. And on the 14th time it does that, I'm thinking maybe a cut here, maybe a cutaway.
We get the idea.
That was, but it could be just Peter Weir learning his trade. Ultimately, if I've had a couple of drinks, I'll happily put The Cars That Ate Paris on as a pleasant post pub film that I'll let wash over me, as I'm told I should have done about Picnic at Hanging Rock. But I'll let The Cars That Ate Paris be my Picnic at Hanging Rock.
You've been listening to the M4 Death Trip. I'm Howard Ingham, and I was accompanied, as ever, by John Deere. You can follow John's writing at viewsfromahill.com and mine at room207press.com. Music is by The Hare and the Moon. Thanks for listening.